You're listening to K-Talk Radio, KBJA 1640 AM.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson on Interpreter Radio with my co-host John Gee and Kevin Christensen. Good evening, Kevin. Welcome to the program. Kevin, are you there? Okay, we'll add Kevin here in a minute. John?
Good to be here. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome to everyone. Just want to take a moment and welcome you to our Sunday evening this evening. And just to point out that we're brought to you, as always, by a cruise lady. So we still have the Ultimate Egypt Interpreter Foundation Tour that's coming up in November. Is that right, John?
Actually, that has been postponed to 2021.
All right.
Conditions in Egypt and internationally have been at a point where it was not certain that it was going to be safe to go, and Cruise Lady takes very seriously the safety of those who travel with them. And so until this last week, it was the U.S. was not even allowing any international flights. So it has been postponed until 2021.
Mm-hmm.
It's the arrangements, as far as I know, are all the same. The dates are the
roughly
same days
equivalent
of the week. It's going to be off one day on the actual date. I think it's the 19th
and it'll be
the 29th of
November. So
November
we're
2021.
We're about 15 months out.
Yes.
Okay.
And so those who have been booked have been notified and given first priority in signing up for next year's tour. Hopefully by that time this will have calmed down, but conditions in Egypt haven't improved that much. There are some tourist sites open, but they're not necessarily open, available to people from any country. And those that are open are only open very limited hours. So mm-hmm. It would have been very difficult, unless something changed, to actually accomplish the tour as it had been scheduled. And so it's now 2021, and we look forward to being able to do the tour at that time. We are sorry for anyone who was scheduled to go and won't be able to make it, but the safety and comfort of the those participating in the tour is of utmost priority.
I've got a friend in St. George, one of my neighbors down there, who runs a travel business, and I'll tell you, that's brutal. My brother was a high executive in American Airlines during 9/11.
Oh.
My younger brother,
yes,
also named John. You would remember,
yes,
John.
Yes, I remember John.
And he said when that hit, 9/11, the airline industry really took a hit, and he never thought he'd see another business, a terrible thing happen to a business like that. And then with this and the travel business, which he's been in for a while, he just barely changed and went to something else. He just said this is worse, especially for the travel business. So those of you who are listening, CruiseLady.com is still sponsoring this program, and check their website, give them a call, find out how these tours are going, because they've even postponed the Oberammergau.
Yeah, Oberammergau was actually canceled by the Oberammergau people. The people who put on the Passion Play just said, So the Oberammergau Passion Play is based on when Oberammergau, many hundred years ago, was...
Yeah, they had the plague.
The plague was coming through.
They had the black plague there.
They said if you if we're spared the play, we will put on or
we'll
the
put
play,
this on
we'll
every
put
10
on
years.
A play every 10 years. And they've done it ever since then, but they're not going to.
Yeah, they were going to do it this year. They were going to do it this year. It was already
it's
every 2020, right?
It's every 10 years and years mm-hmm. ending in zero. So, but that's been put off for 2 years and, mm-hmm. or a year or two, and so.
And Cruise Lady's going to have a going right, to have a tour.
Yes, and but whatever the plans were, they've postponed them.
Yeah.
Something, so the Society of Biblical Literature meetings, which I would normally attend and which I was going to do the Egypt tour instead of, they've canceled this year.
Mm.
And that's 10,000 people that are brought in
mm-hmm.
To one place for those meetings, which, of course, is a nightmare in a pandemic situation. ideal breeding ground for spreading the
Well,
pandemic.
And many of the scholars are a little older.
A lot of them are older. So for years, I've, for example, I usually run into Bezalel Porton there. He's now in his 90s. Bill Deaver shows up, and he's about 90. And so there are lots of senior scholars who would still show up, but it's not really safe for them to.
Mm-hmm.
And then even for the younger ones, it's not always as safe. It's so we're sorry about this, but keeping people safe is something that's important.
Yeah, something that we're working towards. So, John, this week you were able to present at the Fair Conference. And the Fair Conference this year, because of COVID, was handled a bit differently, too, if I recall.
Yeah, let me explain to you how the Fair Conference
went. So you go ahead and
went.
Do that, and we'll see if we can get Kevin on the
line.
All right,
I'll explain how the Fair Conference went this year. Because of the pandemic, then they couldn't hold it in the convention center as they normally did, and instead they chose a smaller venue. There were about 20 seats in the audience that were spaced 6 feet apart, and I think there were only about six people or so in the audience at any given time. They did a live streaming transmission, and so the presenters would come in, they would wipe down everything. They'd wipe down the microphone, everything in between speakers. Everybody was wearing masks except when they were at the microphone. Some of them were pre-recorded. Some of them were live from somebody's home and piped in. It was a very good conference and a lot of good material. And since it's too late to live stream it, if you're interested in seeing it, you can get it half priced on the delayed.
Yeah, they'll start September 1st, I believe.
I don't know exactly how that works. It was a very good conference with some excellent speakers. A few things that, where do we want to start? There were so many good presentations.
Well, let's see. Kevin, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here now.
And were you able to follow the Fair Conference? Were you part of that?
I
know you weren't.
I wasn't part of it this time. No, I wasn't part of it this time.
Okay.
I'm just looking forward to when I get the chance to see the talks.
Well, let's just. It's hard to pick one or two highlights. So let me just grab a couple of them. On the last day, Jennifer Roach spoke, and she is a former minister, convert to the church, and a licensed psychologist. And she was talking about, and she works with, in her psychology practice, she works with victims of abuse. And she was talking about bishops' interviews, which some
people, I remember I saw that.
And she had a very unique perspective because she herself had been a victim of clerical abuse as a teenager. And she talked about the importance of bishops' interviews and brought out a number of facets of the bishops' purposes of the bishop's interviews would serve, that people who criticize them aren't considering. And she was very much in favor of them. And this is somebody who has been a victim of abuse. And she says that it actually plays a much better role for uncovering that than it is the risk of encountering that. Her presentation is worth doing. Elder Kim Clark, an emeritus General Authority 70, former dean of the Harvard Business School, former president of BYU Idaho, and former Church Commissioner of Education, gave a very good talk and a very interesting question and answer. So if you have a chance, get the question and answer. Susan Easton Black spoke.
About Emma Smith.
About Emma Smith, yeah. And
I'm curious, what about the, Carrie Muehlstein spoke, but there was another one, too.
Tim Barker.
Tim Barker,
So I didn't take Book of Abraham, but both of them did. And both of them presented some research which I hadn't thought of before. And Tim is, so Tim's presentation is worth checking out.
Mm-hmm. And his qualifications are what?
He's just been interested in this, and he's noticed something that no one else has. This is one of the... there are a lot of advantages of being a professional and being steeped in it. But there are occasionally things that amateurs notice that people who are steeped in it completely miss.
Yeah.
And Tim came up with one of these. And then Carrie Muehlstein...
And we're not talking about amateur in a sense of being critical. It's a status. He doesn't do this for a living.
No, he's an accountant.
That's what we're talking about.
Yes. And he's just been, but he noticed something that other people, that those of us who have been doing it, and I've been doing the Book of Abraham research now for 35 years, but I'd never noticed this before. And he picked up on it, and so check out his presentation. And Carrie Muehlstein did an exhaustive study of comparing the characters on the various Book of Abraham manuscripts and other things, and has some really interesting and important results from carefully looking at a number of different questions that have to deal with the characters. And chances are, no matter what you've thought about them in the past, you probably didn't realize what he presents. So I'm, Mark Ashurst McGee gave a really interesting presentation about the question of whether Joseph Smith plagiarized in the Joseph Smith translation, which has been...
that's been debated recently.
Right, but what's interesting is he's one of the editors of the volume that comes out, the study comes out of. And it's worth looking at his treatment, but I will note that he noted that of the two co-authors have gone their separate ways when it comes to concluding what this means. So one co-author draws one conclusion out of it, and one co-author draws another conclusion out of it. And I thought he was very fair in presenting the two sides of...
Well, I saw an interview with the one who, left.
Yes.
And she had said, and she was she was the student, not the professor.
Yes, she was the student.
And she said that she did not have anything to do with the conclusion of the published article.
But it also he showed some rather interesting things. So I'm not going to give away his conclusions or try to summarize them. Mm-hmm. I thought he did a great job at being fair to both of his authors as an editor.
Well, and that one is something that's become pretty I'll just say notable as opposed to notorious, right. Because the blog By Common Consent did an interview with these editors, and this comes for those readers who may not know from the producing.
I don't remember the
producing
title.
Mormon scripture or something like that.
It's a new publication on translation.
Yeah. It's a collection of essays by a large group of people. And Ashurst McGee is one of the editors, and I believe Mike McKay
and Brian
then,
Hoglid.
Brian Hoglid.
And those are the three editors. And I thought, and I will say that Ashurst McGee said, if you go for the normal definition of plagiarism, it's hard to say that that's what Joseph Smith is doing.
Yeah.
But but I thought he was also very fair in the way that he handled the two authors that he edited in.
Yeah. Then these editors also did an interview with By Common Consent. They did Times and Seasons reported on it. It was Craig Nielsen. Reported on it, and then Kurt Manwaring had both the editors on to talk about that particular issue, and I thought that they handled it pretty fair. And then I did a little research. In fact, it's strange because this volume has caused me, and I was going to mention this. Kevin spends a little more time, and Kevin, you can feel free to jump in here.
Okay,
dealing with the Reddit and the some of these other places where people are on commenting about the church and they're not as favorable. I'm not into the deep dives of that. I have a lot of other obligations on my time. So, but the two times I have been on have involved contributors to this volume, and because they've gone on either the radio or they've gone online and they've done some. In fact, one of the contributors, I think, did a Mormon Stories with John DeLynn.
That was an interesting presentation. Other ones, there were two presentations on heart and the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
So one by Anthony Sweat and the other one by, and I have to look up, Andrew, I'm sorry if I pronounced this wrong, Knaup and Saul Valuto, that both finished a graphic novel on Joseph Smith's
Pillar of Light.
And but they both talked about the challenges as an artist in reproducing something that's faithful historically and graphically interesting. So Anthony Sweat actually did some illustrations of Joseph Smith's translation and trying to be historically accurate.
Yeah.
And he talked about how hard it is because it doesn't look visually interesting.
Well, you can't show the face if it's put in the hat.
Yeah, so
you have to kind of have a 45-degree angle, and then it's not historically accurate.
Right. He talked about the challenge of it, and the ones illustrators for Pillar of Light said this is talked about how they tried to convey certain things that they used in their drawings to try to convey certain things symbolically, and the challenges that come from trying to be both accurate and visually appealing and interesting, and there's some give and take there, and they talked about the challenges of that, and so both of those presentations were quite interesting for that perspective that they had, because they all work in illustrating that, and they're all faithful members, and they're trying to convey something that's historically accurate, and they have some problems. But if you get Pillar of Light, it's worth going back to that fair presentation just to get their commentary on some of the things that they were doing mm-hmm. that you might not pick up on otherwise.
So they showed some of the artwork.
They showed some of the artwork. Now, Pillar of Light is available for free on the Internet, or if you want a hard copy, you're going to have to pay a little bit of money for it. And they gave the information there. I don't have it off the top of my head. But both of those are, it's worth going through their presentation just to see what they were, have them explain some of the things that they were doing and subtle things that you might not pick up on.
Mm-hmm.
Things that they did with colors, things that they did with subtle symbols. So that's just a sample of some of the things that happened at the fair conference. And
then, of course, there was a presentation from you.
It
was not on the Book of Abraham.
It was not on the Book of Abraham. What I did is, because I have this new book out, Saving Faith, I talked about the material that I'd put in there and some that was from out that I wasn't able to put in the book that specifically deal with the question of how, what's effective and what isn't when you're dealing with people who are losing or have lost faith, and what some of the studies that have been done can tell us about things to do, things not to do, things that were effective, and things that you might think are effective but really don't make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, I was trying to be helpful to the people who come to FAIR and give them something that would be usable. I went through a lot of, there was just so much material I couldn't necessarily cover it all, so I hit highlights and mm-hmm. tried to screen it out for what would be useful. Mentioned a number of issues that are really corrosive to faith that don't always show up in discussions of that. We might focus on polygamy or on translation of the Book of Mormon or something like that, but those aren't really the big issues, and they don't play as big a role as things like relativism.
Yeah.
And so just to highlight some of the things that people ought not to completely forget about that can.
There are the things that are obvious, and then there's the things that are subtle, but that actually cause bigger problems in the long run.
Right. And then there are also things that we don't really want to talk about. So, mm-hmm. for example, and this one, from the questions, a lot of people would rather not talk about it. I'd rather not talk about it myself. But, there's one survey, and there are other surveys, and they give slightly different numbers. And I discussed some of that, but there's one survey that indicates that, and this is according to that survey, that 42% of those who lose their faith say that their lifestyle is no longer compatible with the teachings of the church. You know, that's not something that we'd prefer to talk about. And then there are reasons to believe that that 42% number may be low.
Yeah.
But we'll go, but, you know, we'll, yeah. I went over the reasons why it might be low, but we'll just, even if you take it at 42%. So that's still between a third and a half have a lifestyle problem, either instead of or in addition to an intellectual issue.
Yeah.
And that makes it a lot harder to work with them on the intellectual issues if you don't address the behavioral component. And you need to be aware that a significant portion of people who lose their faith have that issue. So we can't just completely ignore it.
Well, I've talked to a lot of people who assume that it's the vast majority. And I don't know that that's the case, but it's
I don't know.
Study.
I mean,
yeah,
it's
hard to say.
It's it It may be low, but is it 2 percentage points low? Is it 40 percentage points low? I have no idea.
The numbers I talked to would be, okay, 90% or at least 80 who lose their faith, that there's a lifestyle issue.
Right, and I don't know what the exact number is, but I don't think it's high.
That sounds high to me.
And I know people for whom that was not the case. But still, you have to at least know that that's a potential problem if you're going to deal with it, because if you've got a behavioral problem, that makes it much harder to deal with an intellectual problem. Mm-hmm. And we're used to dealing with things on an intellectual basis, and we may have to deal with the behavioral one. But that's more actually your bailiwick, Kevin. Do you want to address that issue?
Yeah. Well, this is one of the things that I think is kind of interesting. My wife's dad was a bishop for 9 years in California, and they left him in because he was doing such an outstanding job, especially reactivating people. And the way that he did it, he'd just go and he'd talk to people and he'd develop a relationship. He said, "Come on, let's take care of whatever it is." And he didn't shame them, you know, he just kind of welcomed them, and he brought them back, and they loved him. And so, probably hundreds of people that he brought back that way, and it's just something that had happened in their past, and they felt, you know, shame and guilt over it. And he helped heal them. You know, so this can be a big thing. And, you know, I knew him, he's a great guy, but he wasn't involved in apologetics like I was and reading all of this stuff, but he was really good at reactivating people and just was tuned into that, you know, during that time. And it's a real question. And one of the things about John's book that is good is because there's, you know, the kind of people who are wanting to say, well, no, I had these intellectual issues with the church, or, you know, I had these political issues with the church and it wasn't behavioral. But that it is a big deal, and that it shouldn't be, you know, there's this element that says, no, you shouldn't assume that. Well, we don't have to necessarily assume it, but we shouldn't ignore it either as a potential. Just before my mission, there's a group of kids that I grew up with. And, around the time when a lot of us were going on missions, there's a group of about 8 or 9 kids that I knew and had known for years, and they just all just dropped out of the church all at the same time. And it wasn't because of intellectual issues. It was just, they just didn't want to be bothered. It wasn't something that they agonized over or had, did searching or questioning. They just drifted off, and that was that. And I've dealt with, yeah.
Sorry, one of the things that we find is that a lot of people just, they can't give you a reason because they don't really know why. They just sort of wandered off. And that happens too. And that's another thing, is that there doesn't have to be either an intellectual or a behavioral reason for it. Some people just...
Sometimes it happens.
They just stop coming.
Kevin, you mentioned something with your father-in-law that really, I think, was a key, and that is... He just went and he built a relationship with them. And then that was more successful than anything. And I think that's the whole key to the ministering program that we have and everything else. If you don't have the relationship at the foundation of it, you're not going to be successful.
Well, and that's one of the things I pointed out in my prayer talk, is that you have the... is that... You can have people who do the research, but in the end, the studies show that it's one of the things that's important is to have somebody locally that they can trust and that they can work through the issues with. And if people who work through the issues, 60% end up in the highest category of religiosity down the road, and less than 1% end up in the lowest quartile of religiosity if they can work through their doubts. And so it's important to work through the doubts, and it has a really good success rate, at least from what studies that have been done on something like this, is that it tends to work quite well. And so it's, you know, the majority of the cases, it comes out with them even stronger when they get through. And that's an important thing to realize, is that this is not a lost cause. Some people depict it as a lost cause, but the studies that I've seen don't seem to back that up.
So on the last presentation, Dan Peterson was there.
Yes.
Head of Interpreter Foundation. We'll talk more about some other Interpreter Foundation stuff in a minute, but he talked about the witnesses. Did he show clips from the movie?
Yeah.
I think the movie's close to release. What, well, a couple of months?
Here's what he said. So his was one of the pre-recorded presentations. And he showed clips from the movie. And he said it would have been released in October if it hadn't been for the pandemic. They don't know when they're going to release it.
So it's been postponed as well.
It's been postponed. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, but it's close to done.
Mm-hmm.
And he also talked about, so it's going to come out and there'll be a theatrical movie talking about this. And then there is, they have a documentary to go with it that you could, that's going to be available separately. And he talked about, went through the witnesses and talked about their importance. And so it was a really, well, it was Dan. So it was a good presentation.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah.
And
he's very media talented.
Yes. much more so than I am. But he did a great job and very clearly laid out the case of the witnesses and the fact that you have a dozen there, and then you have these incidental ones, and he talked about all of them and how they're in different categories. You've got the three witnesses who saw the angel and saw...
They saw the sword and everything else, not just the plates. Yes.
Right, and they heard the voice of God, and so they've got all the miraculous stuff, and... He says you can't really dismiss them as a hallucination because you've got the eight witnesses who had nothing miraculous about what they...
Other than the plates themselves.
Well, they talk about them in purely physical terms.
Right.
Which is how they experience them. Is the plates themselves are a miracle. And he mentioned the Martin Harris one where he... Martin Harris was an incidental witness, and before he saw the plates, he actually picked them up and hefted them, and he said that, and, you know, so he's a farmer, and he's used to judging, picking things up and just judging how much they weigh and what the heft is, and he says, from the heft, they weren't stone, they had to either be gold or lead, and he knew that Joseph Smith couldn't borrow enough money to get that much lead.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he talked about the different types and the incidental witnesses who didn't see the plates but did heft them and could tell how heavy they were. And these were farmers who worked in their hands a lot and are used to hauling rocks and logs and all of that manual labor. And they had a good feel for how heavy they were. And I've actually handled replicas of the plates. Now, they're not made of gold. They're only about two-thirds of the weight of that they people estimate that they were. And
they're
that's
heavy.
A different experience. They are heavy.
Mm-hmm.
When I had access to these, I used to take them for firesides and so forth and actually wrap them up in something so people couldn't see them and then have them pass them along so they could actually heft them but not see them and mm-hmm. to see what it would be like to be one of those people. But that much metal is heavy. And it's not something that I usually work with on a regular basis.
So Kevin, this week, I guess Interpreter Foundation has released three new books. One of them a couple of weeks ago. The Temple Seminar from 2 years ago finally came out. Sacred Time, Sacred Space, and Sacred Meaning. But I don't know if your presentation is in it, John.
Oh, I know it isn't in there. Because I never finished writing.
Okay.
My problem
is
I was going to say,
there's a lot that's missing from that one. And I thought the story behind it was. So it's confession time. And then we'll go into our page six.
I've got 10 things that are on that I've. So I've got 10 items in the last 2 weeks that have been sent to me telling me that I need to revise and submit. That's actually one that's a holdover. I'm kind of buried right now. And I got my presentation done for fair, but
probably
that
at 2 o'clock in the morning the night before.
No, actually, I got a little bit. Wasn't quite that bad.
So, Kevin, you've got something that just came out as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a fresh rift for Lou Midgley that's been coming for a long time. It was announced. They were supposed to have it out, I guess, last November, and then COVID stuff hit and got delayed and delayed and delayed. And then I finally saw on the website for Ebon Books, they said they had 9 copies available, so I bought one. It's called Remembrance and Return, and it has a number of articles, including one that I wrote. I wrote the initial thing in 2012, so
yeah, well,
it's been 8 years.
Yeah, 2012. It was supposed to come out in 2012. So it's been delayed 8 years.
John's got a contribution in there.
Yeah, my contribution. I have a contribution in there. And, it's been delayed because the publisher just, after they'd approved it and it was all go, said, oh, we're not going to publish this. So they had to get a different publisher. So I haven't seen anything on that yet. Mm-hmm. The one that I do have, I actually have in my hand.
But that's a different one.
This is a
third one that just came out this week.
This came out this week on Thursday.
It's not available to the public quite yet, I understand. Dan's
I brought my copy. This is called Seek Ye Words of Wisdom. It's essay Studies in the Book of Mormon, the Bible, and the Temple in Honor of Stephen D. Rex.
And they gave that to him, I believe, Thursday.
They gave it to him Thursday, and they managed to keep it secret from him until Thursday, which, all things considered, was amazing that they could keep it secret from him that long. Stephen, as always, was very gracious in receiving it, and the number of the contributors came there, and we were spaced out in clumps. You know, I was near my wife, but we tried to do all and masks everywhere and hand sanitizer and all of that, trying to keep it safe. Usually, by the time you get a Festschrift, you're a little more advanced in age, and certainly want to keep people safe. And so, this one has a number of articles. We'll just run through the authors: Dan Belknap, Matt Bowen, Andy Hedges, Paul Hoskison, Camille Frank Olson, Dan Peterson, Noel Reynolds, John Twetness, who passed away before this came out, Kent Jackson, Sean Hopkin, Don Perry. Shirley Ricks, this is why it was interesting.
I was going to say.
his wife contributed something, and she has a PhD, and managed to do this and keep it all secret from Stephen. Gay Stratherton, Jack Welch, David Calabro, Jennifer Lane, Navram Shannon, and I have something.
And, of course, you, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a challenge writing that. I was in Heidelberg and didn't have access to my library when I was writing it. Mm-hmm. Of course, I did have access to a fantastic Egyptological library, but I didn't have access to some of the books that I needed to use for it. And so, I was able to put in some of that material after I got home. But it's a lot of important things. And Stephen announced that he just finished the manuscript on the Book of Mormon Onomasticon, which is an analysis of all of the names in the Book of Mormon. And he and Paul Hoskinson have been working on that individually and together for, 35 years, at least. And so that will be nice to see when it comes out.
And how does that compare with the one Matt Boehm did?
Well,
is just the one on the names, right?
Right. This is basically an encyclopedia. You look up a Book of Mormon name and they'll tell you what's known about it, where it comes from, what it means, when they know that. And they worked on this for, I know they were having weekly meetings for about 10 years going over this material. But every proper name in the Book of Mormon is in it. And they tried to include everybody's suggestion who'd ever said anything about it. Hugh Nibley, Joanne Hackett, John Twetness, anybody who'd made a suggestion. And they evaluate the suggestions, and sometimes they say, yes, this is good, and sometimes they say, well, this doesn't work as well. And mm-hmm. sometimes in cases you have two or three suggestions, and so they evaluate those. And so that will be exciting when that mm-hmm. is actually in print. If you're there, it's available on the BYU Library website, or at least an earlier version of it. It's something like onoma.library.byu.edu. I don't know if I remember the web address, mm-hmm. But you can find it there.
Okay. So on a much lighter note, Don Perry continues to publish. He did his Isaiah thing, and now he's got this one from Deseret Book called 175 Temple Symbols.
And he's got another one that just came out, too.
Yeah.
I don't remember the title. I should remember the title.
Is it with Religious Studies Center?
Yeah, it's with the Religious Studies Center. Yeah. It's on Hebrew figures of speech in the Book of Mormon.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
Don has done a lot of work in this area, mm-hmm. has been, came out about 20 years ago with a book on that went through the Book of Mormon on the poetic parallelisms in the Book of Mormon, which is a really nice book.
Yeah.
And unfortunately did not get the distribution that it deserves. That's very good. But both of those have come out recently. And Don Perry, this is the third book that Don has put out this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say.
He did one through Brill on the
Isaiah variants. Yes.
We'll
call him the James Patterson of LDS scholarship.
Well,
James Patterson writes one about every month.
Don is maybe not that prolific, but he's also a fantastic teacher.
Uh-huh.
And he's a great colleague. And so, but he's been interested in Dead Sea Scrolls and Isaiah,
mm-hmm.
in the Book of Mormon, in temples, and...
Yeah.
And you can see that in what he's produced this year.
Now there's another one coming, if it's not here yet, on the Jaredites from the Book of Mormon Academy. I don't know what you can tell me about that, but it's similar to the Abinadi book that came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, the Book of Mormon Academy, I don't know if they do this every year or every other year.
I think it's every other year.
It's largely something that's done in-house in the Department of Ancient Scripture, and they've rotated people that they've had involved in organizing it. And so I can't tell you really anything more than that about it.
I've just seen it on the schedule for, and hopefully it'll be out between now and when we meet next month.
Yeah, well, the Religious Studies Center is another one that seems to be producing about a book a month.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to keep up with all of their offerings, and they have a wide variety.
And you just go to the website.
Right. But I've published two books with them. They're great people, great to work with, and they also have a policy that after a couple of years, they make the book available on their website, at least in an HTML format. And so they don't get the publicity that they deserve. So if you want to go to rst.byu.edu, they have a lot of great resources there.
Yeah, they do.
And so it's worth looking at what they have. And they have done a lot of stuff with church history, and especially with things like church history in places that if you're not there, you may not have thought about the history of the church in the Polynesian Islands or in...
Mm-hmm. Well, they did one on Kalaupapa, which is the leper colony in Hawaii.
That was one of their recent books.
Woods. Fred Woods has done a lot of those kind of volumes.
Fred Woods he has done a lot of work in that area. He's another one that you just have to stand in awe of how much he is able to get done. And they've done all kinds of things. They have histories of individual temples, and so it is worth looking at their
offerings
and know that they're coming out with a new one every
month. On my radio program, I talked about the one on 1820, which is basically 10 different little biographies or visionettes, if you will, about things that were going on in the world in the year 1820.
Yeah, that was Richard Bennett's work.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was a little surprised because Richard Bennett has been all of my experience with him has been, you know, LDS related, the pioneers and Missouri and other things. And then to see this, I was expecting, okay, he's going to talk about the first vision. And it was completely different.
It's what else was going on in
1820. And I was just fascinated by it.
Yeah, it's he does some really interesting things, and it's worth checking out.
So that leads me to a book that's coming out Tuesday. We talked about it a little bit off the air, and Kevin, you might be a little familiar with this as well. In the Wall Street Journal this week, they reviewed a book called Veritas. And
which is interesting, since that's the it plays in. So that's the Latin word for truth, and happens to be the motto of Harvard.
Uh huh.
And since one of the key players is at Harvard, it's an interesting tie in that way.
It's by Ariel Sabar, who wrote a long piece in the 2016 July-August issue for the Atlantic Monthly. Atlantic has been scoring some of this pretty good.
Yeah,
because just last time we talked in our what I've come to call our page six section for biblical studies, and John is just laughing over here. You can't see him, so he's gone away from the mic. But you know, last time we talked about
scooped so many scholars on that.
Yeah,
and so in many ways deals with a forgery that was called The Gospel of Jesus' Wife.
Yes, and it was announced by Karen King, Harvard professor.
Harvard professor,
2012, in 2012, at the Vatican. She went to the Vatican and gave the presentation.
She did it at the Coptic Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And so she... Actually, I thought that was in Paris, but... So she did the International Copy Conference and announces things in a big bombshell. And the scholars on it were largely a lot like the blind men and the elephant. Because we did... It caused a huge scandal when it came out, and she jumped the gun a bit. She should have.
Well,
she had it accepted
okay,
for Harvard.
According to the magazine article, she showed it secretly to major media, and then the Atlantic sent this guy. He was the only reporter in the room when she made the announcements. She had other scholars there. But he was the only one in the room.
But she had the press releases already.
Yeah, everything was all ready to go and everything and so forth. So, yeah, she...
a lot of scholars were a little bit miffed because there are lots of these announcements. And the usual thing you do is that you publish it or you may make an announcement about a text in scholarly conferences. But you publish it scholarly first, and then you worry about the news reports.
Mm-hmm.
And half the time they don't come. More than half the time. So really this happens all the time. But she really sensationalized it. And Professor King has her niche in Coptic studies, but she's not... If you look at the way the Coptic scholars are, she's not one of these elite group people, and she's not one who normally deals with publication of new texts. And I saw the news reports, looked at the pieces. So I'll use my own example of how the blind men and the elephant. And this reporter has actually scooped us all by getting the big picture story.
Yeah.
And so this book will be an interesting read. I looked at it, and the news report had said that Stephen Emmel, and I studied with Stephen Emmel, and he is the only Coptic professor on the continent. He's an American and beat out two Europeans for the post. And they usually prefer Europeans.
Where's he at?
He's in Munster.
Munster, okay.
Great guy. I love Stephen Emmel. But he said, this looks fishy. And that was enough for me to say, okay, I can tell you Stephen Emmel stories for the rest of the program, but I'm not going to.
Because we only have 3.5 minutes.
Yeah, well, so I started looking about what he saw fishy, and I found 2 or 3 things that indicated it was a forgery. That was good enough for me. I put that up on my blog. But other people, so Tom Wayman looked at it and spotted something I didn't see. And he says, there are 5 different styles of epsilons on this.
The article notes there were typos almost. As if it was copied from something that had been,
no, they,
had
somebody else figured
typos.
Out where it was copied from. Micah Ross said, "This is weird. You have no partial letters on this document. And when have you ever seen a document fragment that didn't have any partial letters to it, that didn't have margins on it?" And so. We all saw little things that were wrong. Leo DePite wrote a big, long article in Harvard Theological Review about why he thought it was a forgery. And somebody else picked out that actually figured out where passages
where it came
were.
From.
The thing I noticed on it is that they use the singular article. So Jesus, it's called the Gospel of Jesus' Wife because Jesus refers to my wife. Except that's not, they use the plural word for wife as an irregular plural. So it's my singular wives plural. So the article doesn't match, the number of the article doesn't match the number
of
the noun.
I think Orson Pratt and Parley Pratt would probably be okay with that.
Well,
right?
what it indicated to me is that it wasn't written by a native speaker. And there was also, it used the wrong writing instrument. There are all these problems with it. But we saw individual problems. But this reporter has actually figured out who forged it and given his backstory. And this is one of the, this forger has had one of the bizarrest careers I've ever heard of.
Yeah, yeah. There's pornography involved, all kinds of weird stuff.
Well, you know, I've heard of a lot of things for washed out Egyptology students, but I've never before heard of a washed out Egyptology student who became a porn star.
Well, he's not a porn star, but
he
think he's a producer.
Well,
I don't know any more about it, but I am looking forward to this book. The magazine article was intriguing.
Yeah, the magazine article said he was actually starred in some of this.
There's even more in our page six, but we're not going to get to it. So.
All right.
Anyway, just want to thank you all for listening. In our next hour, we're going to be talking in our Come Follow Me section about 3 Nephi chapter 1 through 7. Because John and I have hogged the microphones for the first hour, Kevin is going to be leading us in our first section. So just want to thank you all for listening tonight. Once again, we are brought to you as Interpreter Foundation by the cruiselady.com, and we'll talk a little more about the upcoming cruises that have been postponed and some other things when we get into the next hour. So those of you who are listening, we want to thank you for staying with us and join us right after the news break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to K-Talk Radio, KBJA 1640 AM.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson, one of your co-hosts here on Interpreter Foundation Radio for the second half of our broadcast this Sunday evening. It's a beautiful evening here in Salt Lake City. And those of you who are listening online or around the world or podcasting or anything else, we want to thank you for being with us. And we also want to thank our sponsor, the cruiselady.com. And as we were talking with John Gee earlier, they have just recently announced that the Ultimate Egypt Interpreter Foundation Tour is being postponed for a year. And there are some other cruiselady.com cruises that were supposed to happen. There was one on the, I think, Germany. There was a Book of Mormon one in April. There was Oberammergau with, I think, Jack Welch was going to that.
Yes.
And that's been postponed for at least 1 and maybe 2 years. So if you're interested in any of that, I would just encourage you to go to cruiselady.com. The travel business right now is being hit probably harder than any other business that's out there. Harder than restaurants, harder than bars. Way harder than, well, never mind.
Well, it's actually a part of all of, so all of those industries are being hit hard.
Yeah.
So the hotels, restaurants, they're all hit hard, but
the
airlines,
travel,
it's understandable. It's very sad for those people in those industries and for those people who are relying on the industries.
Yeah.
So I've had, so far, 3 conferences for this year that have been postponed, and part of it is it's not clear that I would have been able to take the trips anyway, or that the airlines would have been working.
Sometimes you can't. Sometimes when you go, you have to quarantine for so long. There's no point.
Yeah, it's 14 days, which you know, if you could. I wouldn't mind spending 14 days in some place like Munich, but the problem is you can't.
Room.
But yeah, you're in your hotel room. That's really boring. And then you'd have to quarantine when you came back. So you're talking about having
taking
to quarantine
yourself offline for a month.
For a month, and that's very difficult.
That's
for
what
people
Zoom is
to
for,
do.
I guess.
So I'm amazed at how inventive we've become in trying to overcome these obstacles, but the obstacles are still there. And, but Cruise Lady is doing their best to meet the needs of their customers. And so, and they're hopeful that things will still work.
And so we would just encourage you to check the website.
Give them a call.
Yeah, give them a call. Check the website. We just want to thank them for continuing their sponsorship of this program during this tough time. And our hearts go out to them, and we want to encourage you to support them as much as you can. And I'm sure that they'll make everything right at some point when they're able to. And in the meantime, this evening, we have our Come Follow Me presentation. our area that we're covering tonight is called Lift Up Your Head and Be of Good Cheer, which seems to be pretty appropriate for what's going on in the world right now. It's 3rd Nephi 1 through 7. And
we get the Nephite lockdown.
We get the Nephite lockdown. Yes, we do. And, you know, I got to tell you, Kevin, reading this section was a roller coaster for me because they go up and they go down and they go up and they go down. And as I've looked at this over the years, I thought, the question whenever I talk to anybody about it is, how in the world did things change so quickly, both for the good and the bad? And what do you think, Kevin?
Well, I think about that differently now that I'm 66 years old than when I did, you know, going through as a kid, you know, reading the Book of Mormon in seminary in ninth grade for the first time, you know, just pushing through it. And now the up and down seems a bit abrupt, but now we'll just kind of look back at social history that we've gone through here and look at some national histories of some countries where, you know, things do come and go very quickly here, you know, as Alice says, of Wonderland. But it's living in the moment, you know, that we are. You know, we can just look forward and back, and it's the history is going to give us some idea. And I remember Lewis Midgley talked about how when he went to New Zealand as a missionary, and he, you know, had his own American ways of reading the Book of Mormon and ways that he thought it should be read. He said he was really startled by how they read it, how they applied it to themselves. And one of the things that they really saw themselves in this tendency to fall back and to slip back very quickly is one of the things that they identified with. So, you know, nationally and culturally, I think it's the sense of people surprise you. You know, this sense of, you know, self-interest when it's just they're tired of, you know, doing the sacrifices and like, you know, they like the idea of lockdown. Okay, yeah, we'll lock down if we have to. And then don't. And I was just reading a thing that in New Zealand that they've just had a benchmark. They've gone 100 days without a single community transmission in New Zealand. And how did they get there? Well,
living on an island helps.
Yeah. Well, it's also more than living on the island. There is a law irrevocably decreed in heaven before the foundations of this world upon which all blessings are predicated. And when we obtain any blessing from God, it is by obedience to that law upon which it is predicated. We haven't obeyed the law. Mm-hmm. We haven't done what, you know, should be done. You know, there's you know, that we haven't taken it seriously enough to do what we needed to do to get the blessing. And people are just being tired of, you know, being righteous. But, you know, and this is one of the things that goes on in 3rd Nephi is you know, this starting, you know, when people are starting to, in the commencement of the 92nd year, behold, the prophecies of the prophets began to be fulfilled more fully, for there began to be greater signs and greater miracles wrought among the people. But there were some who began to say that the time was past for the words to be fulfilled, which were spoken by Samuel the Lamanite. And they began to rejoice over their brethren, saying, behold, the time is past, and the words of Samuel are not fulfilled. Therefore your joy and your faith concerning this thing hath been vain. And it came to pass that they did make a great uproar throughout the land, and the people of believed began to be very sorrowful, lest by any means those things which had been spoken might not come to pass. And they did watch steadfastly for that day, that night, that day which should be as one day, as if there should be no night, that they might know that their faith had not been vain. Well, this is a, you know, current theme. They're having a crisis of faith. You know, there's a lot of people this is, you know, an issue that they want to talk about, and some want to inflict on other people.
Well, yeah, on the heels of that, there's a day set aside by the unbelievers that they're gonna kill them. If it doesn't happen, hey, it happens by today, or we're taking you out. That's a little unusual for the Nephite society up until this point. It's like an overkill response. And I don't think it came from a vacuum.
Well,
I
think when, you know, we talk about how fast the change goes, you just look at this year in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, no one could have predicted that we'd have two straight months of rioting in certain cities at the beginning of the year. And, or, no one really, at the beginning of the year, nobody predicted this pandemic was coming.
Entire sections of the economy shut down, and some of them still shut down, and varying from state to state, and just, you know.
The overrunning of religious freedom.
Well, that's a big one for me. I guess down in my neighbors in Las Vegas, a church there rented a casino. Because you don't have to space and you have much more volume in a casino, so they rented the casino to hold their church service. Sometimes those things don't make sense. But
well, that was partly because they haven't been consistent on
right.
on applying
right.
the religious freedom. Because on the one hand, they struck down New York and. I think it was the appeals court said, you know, if you're going to support the riots, you can't shut down the churches because.
But they did it in Nevada and they did it in California, and those were both Supreme Court decisions.
Right.
So,
and this
yeah, it's just hit and miss, and it undermines the confidence. But I think the point that John makes is a valid one, Kevin, and that is it can change so quickly in ways that we don't anticipate beforehand. So I think I think my immature, if you will, view of that is like, gosh, I'm living it right now. Maybe I should mind my P's and Q's and pay more attention to particularly this section of the Book of Mormon.
Well, and the difference in the mentality of the lockdown. So Laconia said, we're gonna all gather together. So this is kind of the opposite of what we need to do in the pandemic, but we're going to isolate ourselves and we're going to be prepared for 7 years to hold out for. And they didn't end up having to hold out for 7 years, but that's what they went into it. Is that this has gotten so bad, we're going to isolate ourselves for 7 years and just plan on that. And I think that's a little different than, the mixed messages we've gotten about this pandemic, because I think we would have looked at things very differently if they said, we don't know how this long this is going to last, but why don't you plan for 7 years? And maybe that would have been more realistic, but the other thing that's really interesting is how unified that they were in doing it. And as a blessing from that, it did last a while, but it didn't last 7 years.
Yeah. So Kevin, what were some of the things that you see they did that caused the unity to enable them to survive these challenges?
Well, sometimes surviving the challenges, it's just realizing that they do have to unite. They do have to start trusting God. They do have to pull together. And there's that moment. People have to be, and people have to be willing to be convinced of the error of their ways and confess their faults. You know, it's one of the things where, you know, people are saying it, like in the first chapter, after the sign comes and everyone is shocked, and you go, oh, okay, maybe this is real, which only lasts for a surprisingly short time. But they have to be corrected on whether or not to keep the law of Moses, and they have to wait, you know, in the future for that. But then there's the problem of the Gadianans and that people being, you know, led away by that, and that becoming gross from being an annoyance to becoming danger, and that leads up to this, you know, story that John's talking about, is about where Laconius decides that they have to pull the people into the center. There's a really good article in the book Warfare in the Book of Mormon that talks about this particular thing, and how, I think Daniel Peterson's article on guerrilla warfare, and how this, what this does is it takes away the advantage that the guerrillas had over them. and because the guerrillas are able to come in and steal food and everything, and then go off and hide in the mountains, and the regulars, you know, don't know where they are, and because the guerrillas get to choose the time and the place of every attack, so they only need to attack when they're in strength, and the regulars don't know where they're going to have to defend because they don't know when the next attack's going to happen. So there's this uncertainty and this terror, but this pulling together just turns the tables on them. So that the guerrillas who are used to stealing food for a living, there's nobody there to steal from. So eventually they have to say, well, maybe if we don't want to starve, maybe we've got to plant crops. And then they're the ones that are sitting ducks. And so this whole strategy, as Peterson and others have commented, it's this brilliant thing that they come up with to deal with that situation. And again, John said, if you're committed for 7 years to do whatever it takes, are you willing to do whatever it takes? Well, I'm willing to do, until it gets difficult, until I'm frustrated or I'm bored. are you willing to do whatever it takes? And it demonstrates that kind of thing that even after, of course, all of this successful campaign, then we can still have the problem of some people just, giving up on their faith as soon as things get a little bit easier, or if they sometimes if they forget God, or if things get hard, sometimes they repent, sometimes they forget God because things are getting hard. So it's powerful stuff for us to read and think about in times like this.
I think one of the other things that helps with the unity that Terry asked about is in 3 Nephi 3:12. The governor was a just man and could not be frightened by the demands and the threatenings of a robber. So I think there are two things here that help increase the confidence in the program. One is that they know that he's a just man. And when you can have that sort of confidence in your governors or the people who are managing the affairs, then it's... When you know that they're just, then it's easier to follow them when they ask you to do something exceptional. And the other thing is that he's not frightened by the demands and threatenings of a robber. And so I'm in higher education. What I notice about this is that there are a lot of administrations in higher education in this country where... The minute you get demands and threatenings, they cave. You can debate whether it's a good thing or not that they cave, but it makes it harder for them to lead people on a program in a unified manner because you don't know when they're going to cave at somebody's unreasonable demands. And from a leadership standpoint, that may undermines the leadership and thus undermines the unity, is that if you know that somebody is just and you can see that even if they're making unpopular decisions, this is at least a just thing to do, then it's easier to have confidence in.
And that's kind of the hard thing about what's going on now, because even in my own experience, we're reopening our school district in Washington County. We have very inconsistent rulings from the state about what to do with the children in this instance or that instance or whatever.
And I think Utah has actually been more consistent than some states.
Well, no, much better. But, it's fascinating when you ask for a clarification and the government itself says, we don't want to put that in writing. Those are red flags. And I don't care what government you're with. I don't care what party you're with or anything else. It undermines that confidence that Laconius had because he was a just man. But like you said, I think it was a factor. And it wasn't just I think we can infer from this that it wasn't just the threatenings of the robber that he stood up to. I think he stood up to wherever it came from to do the right thing. And the people had the confidence in it. And that's consistent, I think, with all of the great leaders in the Book of Mormon that we've run across all year, is they do the hard thing, but they do the right thing, and they are not afraid. And I think a major part of that is because they have confidence in what the Lord, in the Lord and what he expects of them.
And part of this is followed up in verse 19 in chapter 3. It says, it was the custom among all the Nephites to appoint for their chief captains, save it were in their times of wickedness, someone that had the spirit of revelation and also prophecy. So they're looking for somebody who can get inspiration and does get inspiration. Somewhat interesting that Mormon is writing this, who is actually a chief captain and probably knows quite a few who didn't quite follow those things. But looking back at this time, he's seeing Gidgadoni is one of these. Gidgadoni is a really interesting case because it's a weird name.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out it's actually an attested name. We know of over half a dozen.
Okay, explain the term attested.
Okay, so we know of, before Lehi's day, over half a dozen Gidgadonis that show up in the historical records. Nobody knows what the name means. But we know that it's attested. It shows up several times in the Neo-Assyrian record, including one general. Some mention of somebody like that had to have made it to the brass plates and then is picked up and somebody names their kids after this person that we don't have their name, but this is a real name. And it's one of these Book of Mormon names where we know that it's a real name, but we have no idea what it means and mm-hmm. necessarily where it comes from, and nor does anybody else. If you look it up in the list of Assyrian names, it says etymology unknown. So they don't know where it comes from either. But this is a real name.
It's a real name from historical records.
Right, and no references were known of it in Joseph Smith's day. All of this came after cuneiform was cracked in about 50 years after Joseph Smith's death. And so it's one of these fascinating cases. But having the more important is probably that he is willing to seek and get revelation and follow it. And Lyconius seems to be intent on doing that too. And so that's another thing where the people have the experience with their revelation enough that they can say, yes, I can follow it. If we use Elder Maxwell's phrasing of it, they can trust them for the present because they prove them in days that are past.
So one of the other things about the gathering that I noticed is that it used to be everybody gathered to Salt Lake. They gathered to the Wasatch Front Corridor. Now we just gather where we are. And there are temples that are there when they're open that enable us to, receive all those blessings and strengthen, receive the power of the covenants where we are as we're gathered. And so that's kind of like what they did, although in this case it was obviously more concentrated. And in part because the threat was...
The threat is really serious.
The threat is serious. The threat for them was, I was just looking for the word, but it was a mortal threat. It was a mortal threat to their existence. And yet, the spiritual threat to us is just as real. And therefore, we gather in our homes, we gather in our neighborhoods, we gather in our wards and our stakes, and in our temple districts, and we try and resist as the world just continues to get worse around us.
Yeah, and this is one of the encouraging things in Third Nephi, because everything is in general going downhill for Nephite civilization and Lamanite civilization as you approach the appearance of Christ, and yet there are bright spots. There are times when everyone pulls together. There are times when things improve.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going downhill all the time. There are these upswings and good things happen. And as we and we skipped over 3 Nephi 1, of course, which is had some terrible situations and yet ends up with a miracle happening. And so there are these high points, and there are these places where it looks like everything, like all is lost, and yet it's still the Lord rescues his saints. And it's interesting that if you read in 3 Nephi, even though there was that miracle, the people, a lot of the people in the society will say, well, they just guessed right, or they explain it away. And we can expect to see that in our own lives. We may witness miracles, but we also, that they will, other people will just explain them away. And yet, but that isn't a reason to lose faith, is because of what we've seen.
So, Kevin, there's basically two groups here that the lesson points out. One of them is a group of people who have strengthened their belief and become more converted to Christ, and then the other is the ones who are less. The groups go back and forth in terms of the power struggle between them during this period of time. But what are the commonalities between those who strengthen their conversion?
Well, I like this one in 3 Nephi 3:25, where they're the ones that are listening to Kid Gedalia and Lachonis, and they've fortified themselves against their enemies, dwelt in the land in one body, and they did fear the words, in this case, respecting, insomuch that they did repent of all their sins, and they did put up their prayers unto the Lord God that he would deliver them in the time that their enemies should come down against them to battle. And he describes that situation, going on into verse 4, and it describes, the other kind of culture. And they were girded about after the manner of robbers, and they had a lambskin about their loins, and they were dyed in blood, and their heads were shorn, and they had headplates upon them, and the great and terrible was the appearance because of their armor and because of their being dyed in blood. And again, it's superficial. They're putting on the costume of being terrible and a lifestyle of being terrible. But this is just the moment of their great defeat, because at the moment it says that when these guys show up, when they saw the appearance of the army of Gideoni, this is the robbers, they had all fallen to the earth and did lift their cries to the Lord their God that he would spare them and deliver them out of the hands of their enemies. And this is... there's a sincerity in this, and they were prepared to meet them. Yea, in the strength of the Lord did they meet them. I think this is something that we can all think of when we come up with in these situations that are terrifying and are drastic. And if we have repented of our sins, and if we have confidence in Christ, and we can have the strength of the Lord to deal with whatever comes, whatever our faith may be in any individual instance, and we can face it without fear and face it with confidence that all things shall work together for your good if you do, if we walk uprightly. And it's a beautiful thing. And to have these kind of stories in the scripture that resonate, in ways that we wouldn't have thought of last year or 3 years ago or 20 years ago, but to find that they're speaking to us.
Or even six months.
To find that there's something here for us. And there are patterns of this is what's going to happen if you remember Christ and if you look to him for help and trust him when things look bleak. And this is what, and then also to think about the people that are, this that we've talked about, this people being so quick to lose faith, you know, or the rising generation not listening to the words of their fathers, or the theme all the way through the Book of Mormon, you know, we're talking about the generation that hadn't heard Benjamin's discourse starting to go weak, or, you know, the rationalizations, well, yeah, so there was a miracle last year, but now what is, how has God coerced my obedience recently? But it's not coercing, it's inviting.
You know, there's also, I was thinking at the end of chapter 3, Gid Gadoni prepares them. So not only do they repent, but they actually make practical preparations for battle.
Yeah.
They make war weapons of war and shields and armor. And they come out and they're not as fearsome, and they don't have the appearances that the Gadiantans do. They're not dyed in blood or anything else. And when they see the people, they all fall down and pray. And everybody soon, you know, the Gadiantans assume, ah, we've got them, but they're actually better prepared. And, you know, to think of the sort of preparations that happen, you know, the preparation asked that we're asked to do things like wearing a face mask in the time of pandemic. And to make sure, keep your hands clean and other things. All of these things are practical things. Yes, they are an inconvenience, no question about that. But they're practical preparations that also may make the difference. And in some cases, we won't know, and in some cases, we might. But in dealing with this particular enemy, the preparations were clearly apparent to the Nephites afterwards, because it got kept in the historical record. And sometimes I remember reading a little article somebody had written, and says, well, you know, when the pandemic first started, he said, I'd never really paid any much attention to food storage, and I didn't really have one, but I had a little bit of one, and it made a big difference. And I realize now that it was something that, even though it was in the back of his mind, and it's just something that he did, he found out, well, this was a good thing. Because when this first hit, then supply chain problems were a big problem. We still haven't worked them all out yet.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it's kind of interesting, because we see them in Chapter 3 doing the preparation. In Chapter 4, we see them gathering together and then defeating the Gadiantans, basically through a scorched earth policy and staying together as long as necessary. And then when they come out of it, things, they repent, they do well. And then we have an interjection from Mormon, who talks about how he himself is a disciple of Jesus Christ. And he is kind of talking about his time and their time and making a contrast. And he's interjecting himself into the narrative right here, which I find kind of surprising. I mean, he makes editorial comments throughout the Book of Alma and in other places, but this one seems to be more personal for some reason.
This is really the first time this is the place where Mormon introduces himself.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we may gloss over there is that he says he's a disciple of Jesus Christ. And disciple doesn't mean to the Nephites what it does to the people in the New Testament. You know, we talk about being disciples and so forth, but among the Nephites, disciple is a priesthood office.
Is their equivalent of the apostles?
Yes.
They didn't call them that because there were 12.
Right, because they realize that they're going to be subject to the apostles in Jerusalem. But he is clearly saying this is not only that he is a disciple the way we would think of it as a follower of Jesus
Christ.
But
he's declaring the office.
But he's declaring his office. But he talks about, this is his introduction to the reader, and it comes long after he's been narrating, you know, and thus we see this.
Yeah, he's had interjections, like his editorial comment about Captain Moroni. If all men were like Moroni, then the powers of hell would, you know, they melt away.
Right, and he doesn't mention, and by the way, I named my son after him, too. I thought so highly of him.
He doesn't. So Kevin, what else is Mormon accomplishing here?
Well, I like the idea, you know, just noticing that, him introducing himself. But again, he's reminding us, you know, who he is, and he's reminding us about the importance of being a covenant people, about keeping covenants, and about really who they're covenanting with. He says, "I have reason to bless my God, my Savior Jesus Christ." And then he's talking about how he will be blessing, you know, the remnants, and it's all about. And inasmuch as the children of Lehi have kept his commandments, he hath blessed them and prospered them according to his word. And so he's showing us that all the way through these stories, that when they're obedient, they are blessed and they prosper in the land. And when they don't, then the enemies come up to stir them up in a way to remembrance. And sometimes they respond and are saved, and sometimes they're not. And that it's this, sine wave pattern that someone Nibley called it, was like a sine wave, up and down, all the way through the Book of Mormon.
You also get the feeling that Mormon has the sense that he's running out of time, because he's making this, writing this record just before the last stand of the Nephites. And he's got a little bit of time before then. And he's saying, of the records he's got, I can't write 100th part, although he'd like to. But he's abbreviating here because he knows he's got to get the ministry of Christ. And once he gets that ministry of Christ,
he's done, mostly.
He's very sparse on his own record. I think it's too painful for him in some ways.
Yeah.
Because you get a hint of this if you start reading his letters to his son Moroni. That Moroni throws in is he's seen lots of really bad stuff, and he just isn't going to get into that.
But
he may also be running short on time.
It's like what you were talking about earlier. At this stage of the Nephite history, there are still pockets of good. There are still times when the Lord steps in and intervenes because enough of the people have turned towards him. At Mormon's time, that doesn't happen.
Well, even in Mormon's time, it kind of does, because you think Moroni chapter 7 is a letter he writes to his son, is a recording of a discourse that he gives to a group of church members who are still faithful, and you can see it in the way he talks to them.
Yeah.
And so
there's still a pocket, but it's not enough to turn the tide of the nation.
Right.
Because it's wiped out. It's irrevocable at this stage.
Not for the individual.
No.
Maybe for the society.
For the society as a whole, not for the individual, because Moroni's still there.
Right. But there's even a group.
There's a group.
Even in how bad things are in Mormon's day, there are still pockets of faithful saints doing the best that they can. So in remembering that, is we can remember, even if things seem dark in our days, that there are still pockets of good, and we can still create that in our, you know, and especially at this time in our families. So one of the things that will be interesting long term is that, so in Utah, it's, for the most part, the family structure that's holding the church up. It's not the church, even for those who think of the church as a social club, it's not there anymore.
Yeah.
As a social club.
Well, I think when and if things come back, you're going to see a winnowing, because
the people who relied upon it as a social club, they've changed theirs. You know, that tie has been changed and modified to a certain degree.
And you have to. So it's been the case outside of Utah, and Kevin could speak to this, I'm sure. Anybody who's lived in what's sometimes called the mission field can testify of this, where to a great extent, if you show up at church, it's because that's something you wanted to do, and it's a clear manifestation that you're committed. And now that's that way in Utah, because if you're going to church, and there are no congregation that I know of is running at full capacity, even when they are holding meetings. But if you're not doing it at home, it's not getting done.
Yeah.
And so so everywhere in the church, you have to make your own stand, make your own commitments, say that you are going to keep the covenants that you made because that is what you are.
Yeah.
And so we all have to do that right now. And we've been told that the day will come, and we've been told it's past that day for some years now, that we can't survive on borrowed light. So it's up to us to do those things to make keeping our covenants.
As a Sunday school teacher, particularly of 18-year-olds for many, many years, or gospel doctrine, either way, the Come Follow Me program essentially gutted my calling in compared to what I had been doing before. And it's all about what goes on in the home. And it has been for about a year. And I know that's the intention, as painful as it is, because I felt when I was doing the call properly that I was making a contribution. I was helping and supporting and all the rest. But it's still not the same as with the family. So, yeah, those are good points. Kevin, you made the point about Mormon and his talk right here. And then the flip side is, if you don't keep the covenant, what happens? In chapter 6, we immediately jump to that. And this is probably the best example of what everybody refers to, in general terms, as the pride cycle. Tell us a little about
that. Yeah, well, there we get in about how years passing where there is continual peace. There's a kind of a line about, and many highways were cast up and many roads made, which led from city to city, which while you're home, if you've got Disney Plus, you can watch that National Geographic special where they use the lead Ditto and pedal.
That is fascinating. I don't watch much TV, but that was one that really...
Yeah, and that's one. And this is one of the verses that you ought to be reading when you watch that. Then he goes on. And he talks about, and some were lifted unto pride and boastings because of their exceeding great riches, even unto great persecutions. And many merchants and lawyers and officers and people began to be distinguished by ranks and according to their riches and their chances for learning. Yea, some were ignorant because of their poverty, and others did receive great learning because of their riches. Some were lifted up unto pride, and others were exceedingly humbled. Some did return railing for railing, while others would receive railing and persecution and all manner of affliction, and would not turn and revile again, but were humble and penitent toward God. And thus there became a great inequality in all the land, insomuch that the church began to be broken up, yea, insomuch that in the 30th year the church was broken up in all the land, save it were among a few of the Lamanites, who were converted unto the true faith, and they would not depart from it, for they were firm and steadfast and immovable, willing with all diligence to keep the commandments of the Lord. Now, this steadfast and immovable, that goes back to Lehi's wish for his Laman and Lemuel. When this is, they were leaving Jerusalem, he says, that thou would be just like this valley, steadfast and immovable. And that line shows up again when he's describing, the Anti-Nephi Lehi's, the sons of the sons of the Lamanite mothers, they're described in just this way. And then it shows up again here. But, of course, one of the interesting things is that in the dictation story of the Book of Mormon, that part hadn't been written yet or hadn't been dictated yet.
For the small plates, right?
Yeah, for the small plates, yeah. Yeah, so this And he says, and now the cause of this iniquity of the people was this. Satan had great power into the stirring up of the people to do all manner of iniquity, into puffing them up with pride, tempting them to seek for power and authority and riches and the vain things of the world.
Yeah, and this,
and there it is.
Yeah, the, yep. Those things. I remember Hugh Nibley used to talk about these quite a bit, and there are two lists of these, one in 2 Nephi, one in 3 Nephi. This is the one, 3 Nephi, of people seeking for power and authority and riches and the vain things of the world. And those are things to watch for, especially in yourself, is, am I doing this because I want power or because I want authority? Am I doing it because I want riches and the vain things of the world? And I might draw a distinction. It's one thing to have enough for your needs, and it's another thing to seek for riches. Are you deliberately trying to have the nicest car, the biggest house, the all of the adult toys? Is that what you're after? I've known some very wealthy people who have the wealth, but that's not their driving force. And it's not directly correlated with righteousness. But when you're looking, when that's what you're seeking for, is those sorts of things, then that's usually a sign that you need to fix some things. And it's easier to spot in others.
Everything is.
But I've watched it down the line, if that's what you're looking for, how sometimes the havoc that wrecks in your life or in your family or in other things. And if the Book of Mormon is trying to teach us the plan of happiness, then we need to watch that in ourselves. Am I going for this promotion because I am after the power? Am I after the authority? Because I want more money?
It's not the power or authority. I think it's for the prestige. Because, I know that, but it's like seeking for riches. In Jacob, it says, we seek for riches in order to help others. Okay?
That's the way it should be.
Yes. Well, it's the same thing. I mean, I'm an elected official. Right. I ran for office 4 years ago.
Yeah,
I'm running again. And I wouldn't say that it's a position of power, although it does have some authority that comes with it. But I did it because I had certain ideas about things I thought needed to change and be done. And so that's what I do. But you're right. I have to look at my own motives and try and make sure, to the degree that I can, even though I'm imperfect, that they are good motives and not evil motives.
Right. I'm not trying to point fingers at anyone.
Oh, no. Well, don't worry. Everybody else forgets, too. Hopefully the voters won't.
It's something that we need to watch in ourselves, particularly.
Absolutely.
As I say, it's easier to spot this in others, and you do want to pay attention to when you see people who are going for that. But particularly when you see, asking your own motives, am I doing this because I want power? And there are people who really get off on that, and other people who have no problem with that, who might be tempted by riches. Or is this one of the vain things of the world?
Yeah.
There are lots of good things in the world, but there are also lots of vain things in the world. Is this one of the vain things?
Yeah.
Am I serving others
with whatever it is I'm doing? That's a great challenge.
Am I doing something because I'm trying to promote myself, or am I trying to promote the gospel? All of those sorts of. I think that this is a key scripture because it says that this is deliberate temptation, and the temptation is to do iniquity in order to get
the
these
power.
Goals.
Right.
You know, and this is the opposite of Laconius, who is a just man, that he's not doing he's not committing the iniquity himself or trying to excuse it.
He had to seek for the power, but he did it for the right reasons, and he didn't do bad things to get it.
Yeah, and that's
the difference.
And that's something that we need to watch, at least in ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So notice, within 4 years, I think this is a fascinating verse, Kevin, where it says that thus in verse 17 of chapter 6, in the commencement of the 30th year, the people having been delivered up for the space of a long time to be carried about by the temptations of the devil whithersoever he desired to carry them, and to do whatsoever iniquity he desired they should, thus in the commencement of this, the 30th year, they were in a state of awful wickedness. Well, they had just been righteous 4 years before. Here we are. We talked about there was a brief period of about 2 years of righteousness, and then they split up again with this pride cycle thing, and then 2 years later, they're in an awful state of wickedness. And eventually, that leads to secret murders, and that's where the government falls apart.
And where it says specifically identifies both ecclesiastical and government leaders who are involved in the murders. And this leads then in chapter 7 to a complete breakdown of society.
Yeah, and
then
you have a
tribalized.
New guy. Tribal.
And so it's horrifying to look around our current society and see the amount of tribalization that we have. And this doesn't always break along family lines. It seems to be... In our day, it seems to break through family lines and separate the families. But the whole tendency to separate out into our own tribes is horrifying. And I have seen cases where in just a couple of years, it went from a situation where things were not political, and you had people from various different parties working together for the common good, to where it became totally tribal.
There's no ground for compromise. In fact, they don't even sit at the table anymore.
It's
pretty interesting. The election in 2016 was surprising, and if you ever watch all of the coverage from it, in some ways, it's kind of entertaining to see the surprise. But the word that stuck with me, and I've watched a lot of that coverage, whether it's European coverage, French coverage, Australian, international coverage, not to mention all the major networks, the word that was most constantly used, and among all of them, was we are becoming more tribal. This is more tribal.
Or
and
polarized.
Polarized, but tribal was the actual word that they used. And I never, I thought of this the minute they said it, and it just kind of stuck in my head. Do you sense that's going on, Kevin?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the things that that disturbs me about, over the course of my life, is to see the increasing polarization and fragmentation of culture, especially in that people don't listen to the other side anymore, because we have such a choice of media, radio, lots of channels. You don't have to listen to anybody or anything that you don't want to. As the kids, we used to watch, sit down, and they would have variety shows. Well, the whole point was a little bit of something for everybody. And now that sort of thing doesn't really exist anymore, because everything is specifically targeted for a specific group. And, to try and reinforce and exploit that connection. It's a bit sad. And I felt like there's something lost in that. And there are some hopeful signs, I think, where, one of the things that I think was most and it continues to be most interesting about the George Floyd protests, is that it seems that people are crossing those tribal lines to do that, you know, to reach for something, you know, to good, to do some good with it, and coming out and trying to support each other, mostly in peaceful ways. And that's a bit hopeful. At the same time, there is a terrifying polarization and tribalization where
there's a violent element.
I think the opposite.
There.
Yeah,
there's a violent element in there that exacerbates the tribalism.
And there's a lot of thought on both sides where if you don't agree with me, then we're going to destroy you.
Yeah, you know, Kevin, it's kind of interesting because in verse 13 of chapter 6, some did return railing for railing. And there's a lot of that going on, no matter what it is. If you attack mine, I attack yours, and vice versa. And then it says, others would receive railing and persecution and all manner of afflictions and would not turn and revile again, but were humble and penitent before God. And that is the ideal for which, frankly, I probably myself need to do more pondering and repenting on that very topic. Because, you know, it's interesting. When you look at the voting map, you see a lot of red everywhere. Well, if you go county by county, you go state by state, you go county by county, you go city by city, you can go neighborhood by neighborhood. It is human nature for most of us now to live near people who share our same values and kind of beliefs. And so we are more polarized. And to the degree that we let that affect the church, I'm sure that's a problem the brother wrestle with all the time. Because if your ward boundaries and everybody in them are fairly homogenous, but you conflict with somebody that is in a different county or city that has different views like that, eventually there will be dissension in the church.
And most of the stuff in the Book of Mormon the problems come from dissension in the church.
That's where it always germinates.
The big war chapters all start with dissension in the church and spill out.
Okay, well, that wraps it up for this evening for us. This is Terry Hutchinson with my co-host John Gee and Kevin Christensen. Thank you for being with us tonight. Join us again next week with more Interpreter Foundation Radio.